The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.
Hello, this is Ciarán Hancock. Welcome to Inside Business. This week, I'll be looking at the pension pots that auto-enrolment could deliver for workers on an average wage. You'll hear from Dominic Coyle of the Irish Times in a few moments. In the second half of the show, Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times will give me his view on the government's plan to establish two new sovereign funds to meet the future costs of the state. But we'll start with auto-enrolment pensions. The state is planning to establish a scheme for workers who don't already have pension cover in their workplace. It's been much delayed, but is moving forward, and EY this week crunched the numbers to see what workers might get by way of a pension when they retire. Dominic Coyle of the Irish Times has interrogated those figures and joined me in studio to discuss them. I began by asking him to explain how auto-enrolment will work.
Yeah, auto-enrolment is a move by the Irish government to make sure that everyone working who is between the ages of 23 and 60 and who is earning more than 20,000 has some form of private pension, that they're not relying entirely on the state pension. It's driven by the fact that the current figures show that roughly only a third of people in the private sector actually do have an occupational pension.
Now, this is a plan that's been on the books for some time and the introduction has been delayed, isn't that right? So what's the latest plan?
Yeah, this has been going around for decades. This is going around since Seamus Brennan was Minister for Social Welfare. And it follows a similar pattern internationally. The UK has a similar setup, as does Australia and New Zealand. The current government had been promising to introduce it this year and insisted consistently that it would deliver on that. It's now conceded very recently that it will run into the very start of 2025. And that presents its own problems, because we now know, following the election of a new Taoiseach, we're almost certainly looking at an election in the first quarter of next year. And the prospect of taking more money out of people's pockets for whatever good purpose at that time seems a bit of a reach.
Yeah, sure. Now, just explain to us how exactly this is going to work. So what will the employee contribute? What will the employer contribute? And what is the state going to chip into the pot?
This is part of the controversy. As auto-enrolment is currently planned, they will phase the introduction over 10 years. Initially, at the outset, the employee will pay 1.5% of their gross salary. That will be matched by the employer, and the state will contribute a third of that amount, so 0.5%, an amount equivalent to 0.5% of the employee's salary. 3 years down the line, those figures will jump to 3% for each of the employer and the worker, and 1% for the state. It increases again in year seven to 4.5% for employer and employee, and 1.5% for the state. And finally, after 10 years, you get up to 6% of your salary goes into a pension from the employee, 6% from your employer, a matching amount, and 2% from the state.
Right, okay. Now, they're not hugely impressive numbers, particularly in the early years.
They're certainly not hugely impressive numbers in the early years. And part of the problem is, you know, there are a generation of people who went into the workplace when we started talking about auto-enrolment, who will be very much closer to retirement by the time we get this thing in at all. But if and when they do get up to the 6% level, that's quite respectable by international standards. The English authorities or the British authorities are looking at increasing their contribution levels to something approaching that. So you will be looking at 14% of your gross salary, or an amount equivalent to 14% of your gross salary, going into a pension for you every year, which for those, once you get up to that level, will be quite good.
Yeah. Okay, now EY, the professional services firm, has been crunching some numbers on what people might expect to get out of this pension scheme if they sign up on day one, essentially, and they continue their contributions right up until retirement age. And on the face of it, it's quite a chunky number. It's close to €900,000 in the pot at the end of the day.
Yeah, there are a number of assumptions there. I mean, this is that particular figure. It relates to somebody who is 23 years old when the scheme comes in, and at that point earns the average industrial wage of around 47,200 or slightly more.
How many 23-year-olds now will be on that kind of money?
Not many, and that's part of the issue. So in fact, the pot is likely to be somewhat more modest, because you could expect if a 23-year-old is on a salary of 30,000, they'd be quite comfortable that they're doing all right just coming out of college. Mm. So that will lower the figure to closer about, I think, 550,000. But if they deliver according to the EY projections, which also includes an assumption that wages will rise by 2% every year and that the investment return will be level out at an average of about 4.5% a year over the full life of the scheme, well, they get the 888,000 odd.
And what would that pay them in an income?
Well, there's two things to bear in mind about that. One, when we get that far down the line, which is 43 years down the line, remember, 888,000 isn't going to be worth what it's worth today. That's the first thing to bear in mind. In terms of annuity rates available now, which an annuity is a guaranteed pension income for life, that would give you about 36,000 and change if you were just getting a pension income for yourself.
In today's money.
Mm. And if you were looking at an income for yourself and a spouse, then you'd be getting about 33,500. And more importantly, if you were looking to inflation-proof that income, which would be advisable, then that would fall to about 22,000 and okay. change.
Now, you would also be entitled to the state pension.
If it still exists.
Right.
But yes, you would be entitled to state pension and other welfare benefits such as the living alone allowance, the household benefits package, like your TV license and contribution to energy.
TV license in 43 years, of course.
Exactly.
So the state pension at the moment worth €14,420, which is, I think, it's pretty good by international standards, isn't it?
It is. It is. And very much so in the context of the ongoing discussions about unification north and south. Our friends north of the border would jump at a state pension of that amount quite happily.
What are they getting?
It's considerably less.
Okay, so that's if somebody jumps in at 23 and stays the whole course. What if somebody is a bit older? In the article you were writing this morning, you give some examples on that.
Yeah, well, if somebody was going, let's say you took a worker at the age of 38 now, who more likely would be on the average industrial wage, and they went in now and they kept contributing up till the day they retired at 66, they would get a pension pot of, I think it's about 334,000 odd. Which is still substantial. I mean, these figures basically show that you will be getting a pot that's a multiple of the contributions you put in. Now, for that sort of worker who's already midway through their career when this thing comes in, the multiple would be under four times, about 3.5 to 4 times of what you put in. For somebody who's younger and starts putting in from the outset, it'd be closer to five or indeed above five times your what you actually put in yourself. But the thing to bear in mind is this does presume that you do sign that, well, you are automatically signed up, but that you do stay in, because there will be an option to get out of here after 6 months and then find yourself re-enrolled a couple of years down the line. If you start doing that, then it could upset the figures quite a lot.
Sure. If you're 23 years of age and your employer signs you up to this scheme, automatically enrolls you, I mean, as the title suggests, can you say, no thanks, it's not for me now, I'm 23, I want the money, I don't want to lose that 1.5%?
You do. You have to stay in for a number of months, I think 6 months, but at that point you can say, look, sorry, I've other priorities at the moment, pension isn't a priority. If you do that, you will be re-enrolled a couple of years down the line again by the same employer under the rules that are set down in the scheme, assuming the scheme comes in.
Yeah. And if you switch employer, the contribution still continues, still goes into the same pot?
Yes, because unlike current occupational pensions where your pension is tied with your current employer, this won't be. This will be going into a centrally governed fund that the government is going out and organising at the moment, is looking for people to take up the management of that fund.
That process is delayed, isn't it?
Well, it is delayed, and the current timeline is set down by the minister, the new deputy leader of Fine Gael, Heather Humphreys, is, I would argue, hopelessly optimistic. I mean, they're hoping to do the tendering and the everything up and running, the design of the scheme, and ready to go within 9 months or less. The British took closer to 3 years to do this.
3 years?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. We're looking at doing so. This could definitely be 2 or 3 years down the track.
I would expect, for all sorts of reasons, including the electoral reasons, that I was speaking to EY's tax partner Michael Rooney yesterday, the man who put together these figures, who said that that he thought everyone would jump at it, that it was such good value that he reckoned that people would be very keen to get involved in it. I suspect that with an election looming, there's no government is going to take the chance that that's the case. So you're really looking at what is the makeup of the next government, which is very much up in the air at this stage, and to what degree are they going to want to revisit the currently planned terms and conditions around auto enrolment?
And Dominic, can you explain if this scheme is as beneficial for employees as, let's say, if you're a private sector worker at the moment, and let's say you're on the top rate of tax and you're putting 6, 7, 8% of your income into your pension fund, you're getting a tax break on that at the moment.
You are, and that's part of what's making people somewhat concerned. People who currently are members of occupational pension schemes get tax relief on any contributions into it. That tax relief is at their upper level of income tax. So if they're paying 40% income tax, they get tax relief of 40%. If they pay only lower rate, but standard rate income tax, the relief is at 20%. Under this new scheme, the government's giving €1 for every three, so it's closer to 33%. So for those who are for lower paid workers, yes, auto enrollment will be better than the current occupational pension rules. But for certainly anyone on the higher income tax bracket, it will be very considerably worse off.
Okay, and of course, that's not taking into account the fees you might pay a pension manager if you're in an occupational scheme. And if you're lower paid, your tax relief is 20% if you're paying in yourself.
Yes.
So in the round, what's your view? A good plan or needs work?
I think broadly it's a good plan. I mean, the argument that we want to try to ensure that everyone has an adequate income for retirement is a good idea. It is quite clear that a large number of people in the private sector do not. They're relying either on hope or on the inheritance, hope or the state pension, none of which are certain. So a plan that actually gives people private pension coverage is a good idea. I think there are weaknesses with the current scheme. I think the age at which people are coming in is too late. I think women, especially those in part-time employment, may lose out and fall between the cracks. There are concerns for employers that they'll have the additional cost of running one of these schemes alongside their existing occupational scheme for certain employees. So there are a number of issues that are still to be sorted.
And what about the international experience? You mentioned the UK market. Other countries have done this as well. What's been the experience there?
Well, the most notable experience, the big concern was that people would opt out and that they'd stay away from it. The experience very much has been that people do take up the opportunity to get involved, that partly inertia, partly realisation that, yes, would be a good idea to actually get some class of retirement savings, that people, when they're enrolled, do stay enrolled. So that's something to be optimistic about. But it's trying to get the shape of the scheme right and the timing of its introduction right. You know, we're looking at an economy that's still growing slightly. We're looking at interest rates coming down. It's not a bad time to do it. The election timetable probably is not going to help us.
And is there a danger that companies, private sector companies, might look at this as a cheaper way of funding pensions going forward rather than the occupational pension schemes that you mentioned earlier?
The bigger problem is that the state might determine that it's a cheaper way of funding pension schemes than what they're doing at the moment, because it's the exchequer that's paying out the 40%. And they may well decide that on the back of this to reduce the tax reliefs available on existing schemes. So that is a big concern. And also there's a concern that once this is up and running, will the state determine that actually we no longer need to have the state pension for most people and just leave non-contributory state pension for those who actually do not have?
Well, this is a big election issue. Last time around, because they were trying to push the pension age out towards 68, and it became the issue of the last general election. So it would be a brave politician who would decide to axe the state pension, I would have thought.
I don't think it's something they would decide to do by choice, but I mean, the social insurance fund that pays out the state pension is going to come under pressure due to demographics. Now, whether we have the money to sustain the state pension at current levels, or whether we reduce the amount that's paid at, or whether we actually phase it out for certain people, are all questions that are probably 10, 20, 30 years down the line. It'll be our kids that'll be dealing with that, unfortunately, because we've made a decision that we're not going to fund that social insurance fund at the moment by increasing the age at which you draw down the pension for the first time.
Okay. Dominic Cole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. When I return, I'll be talking to Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times about the government's plan to establish two new funds to future-proof the public finances. Back in a few moments.
How can harnessing the power of AI help drive your business? At EY, we combine leading business expertise with cutting-edge technology and capabilities. Working directly with you to plan your strategy, we will accelerate your AI-enabled transformation. To learn more, visit ey.ai/IE.
Welcome back. This is Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. Last week, the Minister for Finance, Michael McGrath, announced his intention to set up two new funds to help meet the costs of running the state in the years ahead. Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times has been writing about this and he joined me in studio. I began by asking him to outline what the funds will be used for and how much tax revenue will be set aside to fund them.
The Minister for Finance, Michael McGrath, announced in the last budget that he was going to formalise the process of putting cash aside for the future, if you like, because we're getting this massive surge of corporation tax into the Exchequer.
And we had a rainy day fund, didn't we?
We did, yeah. And then we had a rainy day fund, about 6 billion in it. Though they didn't like it being called the rainy day fund because it opened them up to political attack, because Sinn Féin
with the weather these days, Cliff, I think rainy day fund was absolutely appropriate.
Anyway, but it was kind of, I suppose, established on an ad hoc basis or whatever. So the decision was made to have two funds legislated for, if you like, which I suppose puts them, number one, on a formal footing. But number two, it also puts the amount of money that has to go in each year on a formal footing, which sums to about 6 billion euro, which, looking out for this year, would probably be fine and still leave room for plenty of manoeuvre in the budget, assuming the figures don't go south in the meantime.
Ahead of the election.
Something doesn't happen in corporation tax. But in the years ahead, I think that's going to be a significant constraint, because 6 billion would be more than most of the budget packages, you know, pre-COVID, if you like.
Is the 6 billion as a figure, is that baked in, or is it as a percentage of our GDP or percentage of our corporation tax or whatever yourself?
Both, without giving you a confusing answer. So there's two funds. One is the Future Ireland Fund, as it's called, which is the long-term fund. And you're right, that is a percentage of GDP, 0.8%, which comes to just over 4 billion at the moment, but that would rise as GDP rises. So that figure would rise. The other, and the promise is that contributions will go into that for the next 12 years. The other is a shorter term fund, and the Infrastructure, Climate and Nature Fund. So you can see the Green Party had their say in the creation of that one.
In the name, at least.
Which is a shorter term vehicle into which 2 billion a year is to go. So that's a cash sum. So the idea of the first one is that it will build up into kind of hopefully a tasty sum of money by the mid-2030s.
Yeah, so we were reporting 100 billion euro.
Yeah. So
does that sound right?
Well, it does. If you assume that the money goes in every year and that a certain level of investment return is achieved, there is a get out. There are get outs in terms of contributing the money to both funds. Basically, if the economy goes south and the public finances go south, then there is a get out to avoid it for a year or two. A little unspecific, I suppose, in terms of exactly, but there is room for manoeuvre there. And of course, it's also open to whoever forms part of the next government to bring in new legislation to change all this. So, you know, the legislation is there. It will be discussed and one would presume passed by the Oireachtas before the budget in October. But beyond that, after the next election, you know, it could form part of the election debate, I suppose. Do we continue with this? Do we not?
Yeah. And of course, we've been down this road before, haven't we? Because Charlie McGreevy set up the National Pension Reserve Fund.
He did.
Many years ago. Must be, I don't know, 20 years ago, is it?
Yeah.
And he put legislation around it. And I distinctly remember him at the time saying he was doing that specifically so that greedy politicians couldn't dip their hands into it. And it would be used to pay future pension obligations, I think it was at the time,
was,
is what they had envisaged.
Yeah.
And they kicked it off with money from the Aircom IPO. And of course, what happened, we had the massive crash in 2008 and post-2008. A lot of that money was, a huge chunk of that money was used to bail out the banks.
Yeah, and I suppose...
And was flushed down the toilet, essentially.
Well, true. On the flip side, I suppose it was good we had it, because if we hadn't had it, we probably would have to borrow more from the EU and the IMF, I suppose, to recapitalise the banks. And, you know, we can go back over that argument again.
I'm not going to...
How you spent and not spent. But
I'm just saying that this is a very wordy notion by Michael McGrath,
but
we could be overtaken by events, as
absolutely
we were with the last one.
Absolutely. And there is, I mean, there is... He has written leeway, or his civil service have written leeway into the legislation that, you know, under certain circumstances, the contributions can be halted for a period. But, as you say, new legislation can always come in. I mean, the thinking behind this, I suppose, to take a step back, is that the fear, the assumption, call it whatever you want, that a significant amount of the money we're collecting from corporation tax is temporary, transient, whatever phrase you want to put on it.
Boom.
Now, you can argue about that because, it's, you know, the money has built up now from whatever it was, $4 billion in 2015 to $24 billion now. You can argue how much of that is transient, how much of it is at risk. Might it go down to 20? You know, on a bad year, might it continue to rise? Nobody really knows.
The rate is going up to 15%
right,
as well. So you would assume that the figure,
absolutely,
the overall figure will be heading north.
Absolutely. That will be worth an extra couple of billion on the bottom line. It'll take a year or two to feed through from 2026 on. But yeah, absolutely. There are other parts of the OECD deal that haven't been implemented, which could cost us money, but it kind of now looks unlikely that they will be implemented in the form the OECD agreed. Now, there could be other countries could come at that in another way. We just don't know. But yeah, for the moment, there's no particular reason to fear that it's going to fall off the edge of a cliff. But the Department and the Fiscal Council have both estimated that, you know, 40-50% of this could be transient. We shouldn't be relying on it. And we shouldn't, I suppose, crucially be baking it into the base of current spending. So in other words, if we start spending this on health and education and welfare over the next 5 years, we could end up like we did back in 2008 or 9, with tax receipts falling and spending commitments that are harder to cut and a big hole in the Exchequer finances.
Now, given that we have all this surplus cash coming over the years ahead and we're putting it away in this in these two funds, does that mean we won't be borrowing for national debt purposes?
The forecast for the next few years are that the Exchequer will be in surplus. The forecasts go out, I think, for about the next 3 or 4 years. They haven't gone out beyond that. Like, we know, I suppose, from experience how quickly that can change, because the surplus stroke deficit in any year is the result of the difference between two very big numbers. So, you know, a few percent fall in revenue and a few percent additional rise in spending, and suddenly, you know, the numbers start to tighten very quickly. But as of now, we don't need to borrow to fund the Exchequer. The NTMA is, which also has a big pile of cash, by the way, separate from this, which
how
was,
much?
I think, over 20 billion last time I looked. Might be more now. So we are cash rich as a country. The NTMA is staying in the market because there's a view that maintaining a relationship with lenders and is a good thing, because you may need to borrow from them in future.
There will be an element of recycling money, right?
I was about to say that. So they are borrowing at the moment as well for refinancing debt that's running out, if you like. So the bonds would typically be issued for 5 or 10 years. At the end of those 5 or 10 years, then you need to refinance that. Or you could decide to put some of the cash pile against it and not refinance it. But generally, they're ticking it over, trying to keep it all balanced. But the Exchequer is in a very strong position at the moment. It's kind of got in a position where, because of the sums, if you like, and the interest rates, that the trends are positive, and it would take quite a bit to upend that. Nonetheless, of course, it could happen. Corporation taxes. The obvious risk is that we're reliant on 3 or 4 really big companies for a very large portion of corporation tax, and corporation tax is a very large portion now of the overall tax we collect. So that's the risk, you know. A sector starts to do badly, or one of the big companies has a really bad year, or decides to reorganize its tax affairs or whatever.
Yeah.
No immediate reason to expect that, but at the same time, you'd be silly not to see it as a risk out there.
Now, this money is our money. It's the citizens' money, taxpayers' money, and
absolutely,
it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And there will be people listening to this podcast, hopefully, and they will be saying, well, I'm struggling to make ends meet, or I don't have enough money to buy a house, or I'm just shy of getting a deposit together for a house. So instead of putting all this money away for a rainy day, whether they like to call it that or not, give it back to me in tax cuts so as I can get on with living my life in the here and now.
Yeah, I suppose the counter argument to that, and I think we're going to see a bit of that in the run up to the election, by the way, in terms of the debate, the counter argument to that is, I suppose, similar to what I was saying a minute ago, that if you start using this money to cut taxes and then suddenly the money disappears in a few years' time, you're in the same way as if you put it towards increasing spending. If you put it towards increasing taxes and the corporation tax money disappears, you're left with a big hole. There's also kind of a longer term thing that whatever analysis you look at, whether it's the Department of Finance or the Fiscal Council or the Central Bank or whatever, we are facing really big sums here, really big pressures on the exchequer in the long term from the population aging. It's just like, it's something that you can't really do much about except plan for it. So we're going to have less people at work compared to the people who are retired or are not in the workforce. And that's going to put an extra burden on the exchequer, because as people get older, not only do you have pensions to pay, but you have healthcare costs are going to increase, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of extra costs on the exchequer. Plus we have the cost of decarbonizing the economy, which is going to be very significant as well. So if anything, the likelihood is that unless we get really lucky and corporation tax keeps flooding in, and we might, but unless we get really lucky, most analysts reckon we're going to have to increase taxes a bit rather than cut them in the longer term. So perhaps it doesn't make sense to slash taxes now and only to have to increase them in 3 or 4 years' time. Best to keep the thing, reasonably as it is. And I suppose in terms of state spending, we have seen huge increases in government spending over the last 5 or 6 years.
The last one was an enormous budget,
enormous increases in spending. And there's only so much you can increase spending by, really.
You'd be surprised.
You can give people their money back, I suppose, as you say, a share buyback or whatever. And one of the interesting things that's happened over the last few years is that a lot of the money that has been given back has been once off, if you like.
Energy credits, that type of thing.
It's become twice off or three times off, I suppose. Mm. But it hasn't been ongoing. It hasn't been tax cuts. It's been, as you say, energy credits or whatever. And one of the conundrums they face in this year's budget is whether to do that again or not.
Is there a country we can look to for international experience of how others have done this? Has it worked out for them? Like Norway, with Norway's, the oil revenue, for
Norway's
example?
The obvious one, yeah. And their fund now supports a significant part of their...
Yeah, but that's oil revenue, I guess. Liquid gold.
Yeah, so it does, it works. It does work. And what it does is, I suppose you were talking about giving the money back to people now. I suppose what this does is it gives money back to people, to the citizens in 5, 10, 15 years' time, because their taxes are going to be a bit lower, because hopefully...
Yeah. Going back to the Charlie McCreevy fund, though, we might have thought that back then as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
What happened was a lot of it was given to bond creditors.
Banks. Yeah.
So we never got any benefit of it.
Here. I mean, I think, the next government could decide it wants to double spending on housing and dip into the treasure that's there. That's there. We just don't know.
Yeah.
But the concept is two funds. One is a longer term one. And the idea is it builds up to a huge sum, and the interest in that is then significant and helps the exchequer each year. And the other is more designed for short term climate infrastructure. And also, a key point of that second fund, the Infrastructure, Climate and Nature Fund, is that if there is a downturn in the economy, we can keep investing.
Yeah, which didn't happen between 2010 and 2013, did it?
I think state investment fell below an annual level of $4 billion after the last crash, which is tiny. And the lesson learned from that is that stores up massive problems down the road in terms of infrastructure and housing in particular.
We're living with that. At the moment,
absolutely. And Leo, interestingly, Varadkar referred to that in his departure
farewell
speech.
Yeah. Finally, Cliff, people listening to this, we've been talking backwards and forwards about ECB rate cuts and so on. What's your sense? There seems to be a bit of momentum building that a rate cut's coming in June. A bit of commentary around that today. What's your sense?
Yeah, I think I've generally been an April or June man, leaning towards June. It does look like June, all right. I think there will be people around the table arguing for a cut this week. I think they will probably not win the argument, and possibly... strategically, what they will be trying to do is to actually bake it in as a near certainty for June. The ECB doesn't have a policy meeting in May. I think they have a meeting in Ireland in May, but it's not a policy.
No, it's not a policy.
So the next one is June the 6th. So I think the interesting thing to watch will be how Christine Lagarde communicates that in her press conference. Does she say, we expect all things equal to be cutting next month, or does she say we'll be looking at the data and it may be time, or what form of words is she going to use? But there's no doubt that the market is anticipating a cut and anticipating that it will be the first of a number this year.
Well, the Greek central banker was out saying recently four cuts this year, 25 basis points each. Is that amounts to 1 percentage point the Greek, off the rate.
The Greek fellow would be at the dovish end, I suppose. Let's say as a central banker's, you probably get a different view from the German or the Austrian. But I'd be surprised if it was less than 0.75 point by the end of the year. And I would probably quite, given the state of the German economy, you talk to businesses here selling it to Germany, and it's just, it's not good there at the moment. Given the state of the big economies, I think it could well be a point lower by the end of the year or by early 2025. So that is considerably good news for tracker holders. Whether the Irish property market needs it is another question. But borrowers will certainly be glad to get it. And interesting to see the banks starting to edge down their green lending rates this week. I think AIB trimmed its green lending rate.
In the Bank of Ireland's case, not even calling them green anymore.
Exactly, yeah. Well, how green they are, how green is my lending? I don't know, you know, is there a bit of greenwashing going on here? But nonetheless, lower rates are welcome. There is an option there for people who have higher BER ratings. There's no doubt about that. The fixed rates still look very high for people, for non-green borrowers, if you like, fixing for 3 or 5 years. I think people in that position would be best to take advice, and, you know, in some cases, it would serve them better to go variable for the moment. Some of the banks have reasonable variable offers, and to let the fixed rates fall a bit before they lock in. That would just be my view. People would be best to take advice on that, I think. It's a big decision for them.
I think AIB is really the only show in town for a decent variable rate.
They're around 4, I think.
That would require people switching and so on. That's just a pain in the head.
It is, I know. I appreciate that. But I think even with the other banks, their variable rates are probably in line with their longer-term fixed rates. Now, they're looking expensive still. Agreed, they're looking expensive. But
you have the ability to switch precisely into a fixed rate if they come down?
Precisely, and I think they will come down. I can't see that competition in the market, you would hope, will not allow fixed rates of 4.755% for 3 to 5 years to persist for much longer.
All right, Cliff Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kieran.
Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Dominic Coyle and Cliff Taylor for joining me on the show. John Casey produced this episode with JJ Vernon on sound. Thanks also to our sponsor, EY, for its continued support. Remember, as a subscriber to the Irish Times, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on X, LinkedIn and Facebook each day. I'm Kieran Hancock. Until next time, take care.
The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.